that after the death of Sungsan Gampo, his work was continued. It didn't come to a stop. More and more texts were translated from Indian languages into Tibetan. Monks started coming in from surrounding countries, including, and this perhaps strikes a topical note, refugee monks from the neighboring state of Khotan, because the Muslim hordes were beginning to sweep across Central Asia, ousting the Buddhists, persecuting the Buddhists, even putting them to the sword in so many different places. So refugee monks started arriving in Tibet from Khotan. But at the same time, despite all this, in fact, because of all this, there was growing opposition in Tibet itself to Buddhism amongst the followers of the Pun. This opposition stemmed mainly from noble families who resented the growing power and prestige of the monarchy, and also, of course, from the Bun priests, who felt, no doubt, that their livelihood was beginning to be threatened. Now, the second religious king, Trisong Detsen, lived in the 8th century, and he was a very, very ardent supporter of Buddhism indeed. But he was greatly hampered in the earlier part of his reign by the hostility of the followers of the Pun. But he did manage, despite that, to invite to Tibet the great Indian teacher, Shantarakshita. We know Shantarakshita today as the author of a very, very great, a very famous work on Mahayana Buddhist philosophy called the Tattva Sangraha in two enormous volumes. There's also a commentary by his disciple Kamala Shila. So this great Indian scholar and philosopher was invited to Tibet by this second great religious king, Trisong Detsen. But unfortunately, his mission was not very successful. He visited several places, he spoke on Buddhism, he gave a number of lectures, but what happened? An epidemic broke out, all over the country, apparently. So the Bonists said, you see what happens? In comes this Indian teacher, in comes Buddhism, an epidemic. The demons, the deities, they are angry. This is what the Bunists said. So Shantarakshita was in a bit of a fix. He himself wasn't able to do anything about it, so he advised the king to invite to Tibet the great Indian master Padmasambhava, who was then at Nalanda University. Now, Padmasambhava was undoubtedly one of the most remarkable figures in the entire history of Buddhism. He was a great scholar, a great debater, a great philosopher, but he was more than that. He was also a very great yogi, a great meditator, a great mystic, a great master of the occult sciences, and if we can believe tradition, he was a great magician too. Now he, having been invited to Tibet, spent about 18 months in Tibet. 18 months, that was all. But during this period, we're told, he brought the Pun deities under control. And we're told, this is what the account the scholars usually give, he incorporated them, willy-nilly, into the Buddhist pantheon, I put this word in inverted commas, as guardian deities of the faith of Buddhism. Now, this is a rather interesting story, and we shouldn't be in too much of a hurry to dismiss stories of this kind as just sort of legendary additions to the facts of history. Stories of this kind have very often, and this one certainly has, quite a profound psychological and spiritual significance. After all, what is Pun? It's spelt usually, by the way, B-O-N, with two little dots side by side above the O. Sometimes it's spelled not with an initial B, but an initial P. But the actual sound is halfway between B and P. So it's pronounced in Tibetan Pun. So what is Pun? Very broadly speaking, it's the indigenous religion of Tibet, if you can call it, in fact, a religion. It's a form of shamanism. Nowadays, shamanism is being much studied by students of comparative religion, and it's very difficult to generalize about it, but it is very, very widespread, or was at least widespread at one period, one age of human history and culture. And in Tibet it existed in this form of pun. And like other forms of shamanism, it's very closely connected with the psyche, as it were, of the people who are practicing it. In fact, one may go so far as to say that the pun deities, or demons if one likes to use that term, are sort of archetypes of the Tibetan collective unconscious. And one may perhaps say that their hostility, the hostility of the pun deities, according to this traditional account, represents the unconscious resistance of the Tibetan psyche to the higher and the more spiritual ideas of Buddhism. They couldn't take them in all at once. The Tibetan psyche was very, very different, after all, from the Indian psyche, so they offered resistance. And that resistance is symbolized, if you like, on the archetypal level, by the resistance and the hostility of the pun deities who created that epidemic. Now, Shantarakshita, though a very great man, though a great philosopher, seems to have been just a scholar. He could appeal, as it were, to the conscious mind of the Tibetans. But that wasn't enough. It seems that Shantarakshita wasn't able to overcome their unconscious resistance to Buddhism, to Buddhist ideas. He couldn't penetrate deep enough. But Padmasambhava wasn't just a great scholar, wasn't just an eminent philosopher. He was a great yogi. He was also a great meditator, a great mystic. And he could, as it were, penetrate. He could, as it were, break through into another, a deeper level, and get into contact with the Tibetan unconscious, if you like, the Tibetan collective unconsciousness and the forces operating in it. And therefore it was he who was able to overcome resistance, to incorporate the pun deities and the forces which they symbolized within the framework of the Buddhist, Mahayana and Tantric pantheon. And not only that, but utilize the energy contained in these archetypes in the interests of the spiritual life. Now, Shantarakshita and Padmasambhava also founded between them, jointly, the first monastery in Tibet, as distinct from temple. And this first monastery to be constructed in Tibet was that of Samye, which was completed in the year 787 AD. And it was built after the model of the famous Vikramashila monastic university in India. Some years ago I had the very good fortune to see a colour film of Samye. Now I'm afraid it's practically destroyed by the Chinese, but this film was taken by the then Indian representative in Lhasa, Upasai Pant, and some years later he showed some of us this film privately in Gangtok. And I also had the opportunity of seeing it twice, this film which he made himself of Samye, when he paid an official visit to it before the Chinese came into Tibet. And it is a very striking and very beautiful place, and probably shows us, or showed us at least, what one of these great ancient Indian Buddhist monastic universities looked like in the heyday of its glory. Shantarakshita and Padmasambhava also ordained seven Tibetans as monks. And this was the beginning of the Tibetan Sangha, the Tibetan monastic order. Padmasambhava, we may say, left by sheer force of personality, if one can use that expression, a permanent mark on Tibetan Buddhism. The Tibetan accounts, in fact, of his visit usually make it out to have lasted for about 35 years. But actually, it was about 18 months. But one can take this perhaps as meaning that in this 18 years, he created such an impression, so forcible was his character, that it was as though he'd lived and worked there for 35 years. even. And he is traditionally regarded as the founder of the Nyingmapa school of Tibetan Buddhism, about which we'll be hearing next week. And he is at the same time very greatly revered by the followers of all sects and all schools of Tibetan Buddhism. If you go into practically any Tibetan Buddhist temple or chapel, you'll see a figure, an image, or a picture of the great guru Padmasambhava. And it's a very characteristic, very distinctive figure indeed. You can well believe that it represents Padmasambhava just as he appeared, because the details are always the same. He's a tall, well-built Indian in the prime of life, with a very slightly mongoloid expression, whereas he probably came from East Bengal. And he usually has a slightly fierce expression. And he has a drooping moustache and a little beard. And he's dressed in princely robes usually, with a lotus cap with a vulture's feather on the top. And he carries sometimes a skull filled with blood, sometimes a sort of dagger, sometimes the dorji, the thunderbolt, and so on. In the crook of the arm there is a great staff, surmounted very often by three skulls. And there are various other details, but he's a very, very distinctive figure. You can't mistake Padmasambhava for anybody else at all. As soon as you see this figure, as soon as you see this image or painting in a temple or in someone's chapel, you know at once, well, this is Padmasambhava. And the impression, the impact which comes across is a very, I was going to say lively, but very living, even one might say very virile, very active and powerful type of person indeed.